So welcome, those chosen few at 8 o'clock in the morning. Oh my God. So, you can, I mean, for me, it's the worst. I mean, I'm certainly not a morning person. So I can understand that most of you would rather rely on the recording, which we presumably have mastered, at least engineering wise. Now, at the beginning of this lecture, I just want to repeat the or want to point you to the respective background readings, right? Because you might ask yourself, ooh, lots of math. Can I understand that from the slides only? And as always, I said there is one background reading text, and this network analysis stuff is taken out of this book, which is depicted here chapter-wise, and you can access the chapters as e-texts from the library. And I pointed you to a instruction that I wrote for the course 2 years ago on our webpage, where you can find that stuff. Okay. And so that book contains a lot of interesting and potentially useful stuff. For example, we have this chapter 2 here, written by Ulrich and Thomas Erlebach, which just repeats the most essential graph theory, right? So for those of you that didn't like discrete Strukturen, potentially this is a nice chance to repeat things, okay? And there's essential algorithms, essential problems, network flow, and even stuff on NP completeness and probability theory, random walks, all the things that we also use, right? So I would point those that have slight difficulties in those fields to that text, okay? And so the text also explains some of the notations that are used in the later chapters. And so this is the basic paper on centrality. So that's chapter 3 from that book, written by those persons. And so the whole book was an outcome of a Dachstuhl seminar. I don't know if you're familiar with that. So that's a famous computer science institution, which hosts one-week seminars that you can apply for. And the circle of participants is exclusive is a bit hard, but they're on invitation only, and then these guys sit together for a week and discuss the most recent problems of their domain. And that was a seminar on networks, and this book was an outcome. So persons tried to produce chapters for a book on network analysis, and here everything is discussed with respect to the centrality indices that we use, right? And today, perhaps we're going to get to chapter number 5 as well, which is written by Sven Kosub, and it's about dense substructures, so social groups in terms of social context, right? And that's this thing that I focus on. And I mentioned, so last lecture we stopped with this rather obscure electrical network thing, which is taken out of this paper here. And Mark Newman, as I told you, really writes excellent papers. And this paper is really well understandable. And this is the background reading for these things. And for those that want to dig a bit deeper or want to get a more full-fledged understanding of the math, it's all in here. And it doesn't require any physics knowledge at all, right? So these are the sources. And each source is linked on Piazza, either as a link or as a full text, yeah? And on request from yesterday, I also put online the teaching materials from last year's course, because Fachschaft asked me, can't we print a script from your slides? And I said, okay, well, they're in constant flux, so it's maybe not a good idea to print a script. because the errors that are corrected and the changes on the slides, people would have that script would miss that, right? So, however, I put them online for those that just want a reference and want a course direction where it's going. People demanded that, so I put them online, right? Good. So that's just for the background stuff, yeah? Okay, good. So let's start. Good. So basically, what we did yesterday was start with this or continue with that centrality measures. And as for the larger course of argumentation, we ended there in that network analysis domain by just stating, okay, good. Where are we? We started from games. We kind of discussed the connection to social media and said, okay, if we want to be able to do social computing, right, and social games perceived as one facet of social computing, if we want to do that as a scientific discipline, we need to have a basic vocabulary, right? And we also arrived at social network analysis because social networks, social relations are ideal examples of long-term social context, right? And so that's one way to kind of analyze long-term social context and make it available for applications. Yeah, so that's why we're doing all these things. And so we had several classes of these centrality measures that were based on distances and neighborhoods, right? For example, degree-based centrality. Then we talked about centralities based on statistics of shortest paths. And at that point, we also introduced the betweenness centrality idea to set things into proportion, right? And shortest path betweenness centrality is one of the classic centrality measures that comes out there, okay? And the next thing that we did was talk about vitality-based measures. So the idea was I have a quality measure on the graph, and I measured that quality measure with the original graph and then with the graph where we took away nodes or edges, right, to kind of get a feeling how important the respective node or edge is. And one example was maximum flow, okay, and that was graph-oriented flow. And that graph-oriented flow is not what we have here in terms of electrical flow. So these are two different things. Especially the electrical flow, which we will see, which we will repeat today, kind of avoids some of the problems that max flow between this has. Okay. And so we ended up with Newman's paper and the contents of Newman's paper, and there was this major critique stating that if I only regard shortest paths, nodes like the C here won't get much shortest path between the centrality, although intuitively, if you regard workflows in social networks, C would certainly be involved in some way, right? And the same applies to max flow betweenness, which has its critique here. So since if we restrict ourselves to a capacity of one for the edges, then the maximum flow that's available between those two subgraphs is 2 units, right? And since that's 2 units, we would not have much flow through C, right? And that's the critique here on max flow between this. Okay, good. And so Newman came up with this idea of random walk. I don't know if he actually came up with that idea. However, that's the thing we're heading for, right? So random walk-based centralities. And before we did that, we wanted to explain something else, or Newman explained something else, namely that random walk based centrality is actually the same as a current flow based centrality, right? And this current flow based centrality, as I said, is not the same as the max graph flow centrality, which it is supposed to improve, right? So that was the starting point. So we had this resistor network, yeah. So nodes and resistors and electrical current flowing through that, and we had a voltage at each node here. There's one unit of current coming in and one unit of current coming out. Okay, good. And the goal is to compute a current flow between the centrality and show that it avoids the problems that we discussed before. Okay, what we did then yesterday. Sorry, cursor appear. No, cursor doesn't want to appear. So we have to wait because Microsoft says you have to wait 5 seconds. Okay. And even if I wait 5 seconds, the cursor is not there because it is not supposed to be there. Okay. Yeah. Well, so we wait until Microsoft decides that I can have my cursor back. Okay. Maybe Microsoft thought 15 seconds would be a super interval. Like, okay? Yeah, 15 seconds is obviously a super cool Microsoft compatible interval. Thank you, Microsoft. Thank you very much. Very nice. Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. So, what we started with is just analyzing that network. And while this max graph flow centrality solved an optimization problem, this electrical thing here is just about computing the voltages at the respective points. Yeah. So that means solving an electrical linear network of that sort. Okay. And so that's basically Kirchhoff's point law, as we said. So what comes in, the voltages at each point must add up to zero, in a sense. Or no, not the voltages, I correct myself, the currents. Yeah. So what flows in the node must also flow out of the node again, except for S and T. And that's why we had these two terms here on the right, and it's not zero. So it's zero for all I and J that are, for all nodes that are not S or T, right? But it is non-zero either for S or T, right? And A is the adjacency matrix, and that's just formalizing or selecting the actual incident edges that are incident to a given node, right? So that's Kirchhoff's point law, and that's more or less inspired by physics, right? Good. Trying to solve that, how does that work? Okay, so what we observed yesterday is that if I sum over columns of the adjacency matrix, what I get is the degree of a certain vertex, right? That was what I explained on the blackboard. So we can reformulate this equation in that form, right, where we use this diagonal matrix, and the diagonal entries of that matrix are just the vertex degrees. And this is exactly the same as that. While when we replace this right side here with this vector S, which formalizes the current inflow and outflow through the source and the sink respectively, and has zeros for all the other nodes, okay? Now, the goal would be to just invert that matrix, as I said, and then the problem would be solved, essentially, because we had the voltages. And with respect to the voltages, as we will see, we can define centralities. Yeah, current flow between the centralities. However, the problem is that this so-called graph Laplacian is a singular matrix. Yeah, and physically that means that voltages are only defined up to a constant, right? So that system of equations is overdetermined in a sense. So what we do is we measure the voltages with respect to one node only, okay, and set the voltage at that one node only to zero, which means that we take out the corresponding row and column that corresponds to that zero node and replace it with all zeros. Now, now we can invert this matrix, and with DV, we mean the matrix where the Vth column has been removed and also the Vth row. Yeah. And now, since that new matrix where we leave out column and row is invertible, we can solve for the vector V, right, for the voltages. And that matrix inversion costs us O of n to the power 3, which is not exactly very friendly, but still, yeah, manageable. Okay. Now, if we add a Vth row and column back to this inverted matrix with values all equal to zero, which just means I measure the voltage with respect to that node for all the nodes, then we would call this matrix T. So T is this plus a row and column with all zeros at the respective position, okay? And since this vector S, as we remember, has only two non-trivial components and zero everywhere else, what we get here is that voltage at node I, assuming a source S and a sink T, is just the difference between those two matrix elements. Okay? Now, what is the current that flows through this node I? Okay. So if I have a certain voltage, I know that I would have to sum over, let's go back here. But if I'm interested in the current flow through that node, what would I have to do? I would have to analyze all the incident edges, compute the voltage differences, and set them into proportion to the resistor. And then I know the I that comes in or flows out, we don't know, through that branch. And the same for that branch, same for that branch, and same for that branch, okay? So since we have solved for the voltages, we can compute that. So this is the sum over all branches, and these are the voltages at the respective branch nodes. And this is the voltage difference, yeah? So U in terms of electrical currents. And again, this adjacency matrix allows us to really select the branches that are actually there, right? So that's why we just sum over all nodes. We could as well sum over the incident nodes and leave that A out, okay? Now, this is the current flow basically that goes through node I if I have a source at S and a sink at T. Okay? So going back one more time. This, if I have a situation here, this whole network, it has a unique solution for the voltages, so I know the currents and I know what is the current flow through that node. And the idea is that a node is more important in a network if it has a higher current flowing through it than other nodes. So that's intuitive. Now, can we come up with an interpretation for the resistors? Okay. I think that's also possible socially, because if you assume that the edges, those branches, are friendships, and if you accept that friendships are weighted, yeah, we can say that if the resistance is high, the weight of the friendship must be low. Okay. So if you know somebody just by having talked to him or her for one time, and he asks you, oh, can you borrow me 5,000 euros? You would say, are you crazy, man? Yeah. Or woman, whatever. So, If it's your brother, for example, or your sister, you might be much more inclined to borrow him some money, maybe not 5,000 euros, okay? So that's the weight that's induced here. And persons that are connected to other persons with a high weight or a low resistance would naturally get more current flow. Yeah? So that's why this is an intuitively reasonable way to compute that. Okay, and so since we know the voltages, we can insert our solution, and then we also have to insert our knowledge that at the nodes S and T we have this special flow here. We can then compute our flow based between this as the influx and outflux normalized by the numbers of nodes or combinations, I should say, of nodes that are in there. So that's the current flow between this at node I. Okay. And I would certainly, what I would do is I would average over all possible S and T configurations. Yeah, that's what I do here. And then I would normalize over these S and T combinations. So since they're 1/2 n times n minus n pairs in the graph, I can do that. Okay. Good. And that's the same we did for other measures as well that assumed some beginning and end, and I have to switch the ends and the beginnings through the whole graph, average this, and then I get an average importance, okay? Average current flow between us. Now, the whole process has a complexity of n times n squared. For the nodes, for everything, we have a complexity of m plus n times n squared, which is, as I said, not really totally nice, but still feasible for a medium number of nodes, like 10 to the 5 or so, yeah? Which is a decent network. Not a real, Facebook's current friendship graph has about 10 to the 9 nodes, and for 10 to the 9 you might run into problems. Yeah. However, what you can always do is sample subnetworks, for example by breadth first search or by random walk, and then do your computations on that sampled network. Yeah, subnetwork. Okay. However, you might say, good, nice, well, same as yesterday, physics, solving, yeah, I accept that, but what's the point, right? So the point will be that our random walk-based centrality, which we're going to look at now, is actually identical to this current flow. Now, what did we want it to do? Okay, so we wanted to compute a random walk-based between this. The principle was that I said I have a random walker walking on the graph, making random transitions to other nodes, respecting the edges, naturally. Yeah. And then I wanted to count how often a certain node is visited. If a certain node is visited more often, then we have the intuition that it's more important or more central. Okay. And what we want to do is, once again, we want to start at some node S and end the walk at some node T. That's why we call this an absorbing random walk, because it ends at some node T. Okay. And what we also want is that we want to count the net number of times that a node is passed through. And so we want to leave out these back and forth passes that can result from random movements. So, assume you're in a node J. What is the probability that you are at node I as a next node? Okay. So what we already can see is that it is certainly inversely proportional to the degree of J. Why? Let's say if I'm J and I have 3 incident edges, I would choose each of the 3 edges with a probability of 1/3, right? If I do this evenly, okay? So it's 1 over, this probability is 1 over kj, And naturally, I would only choose a next node I if I'm adjacent to that node at all, right? If that node is somewhere else in the graph, I cannot choose it because I have to follow the edges. That's why the probability Mij is this expression. And certainly this is a matrix, yeah? And this matrix then is computed in that fashion, adjacency matrix times the inverse of our diagonal matrix containing the degrees on the diagonal. So you know that if you have a diagonal matrix with values on the diagonal, that's our D, right? And so this implies that D to the minus 1 is just 1 over, has just 1 over these entries on the diagonal. Right? Because if you multiply those two matrices, you would get the unit matrix. Okay? So that's why we'd have this inverse here. But computing the inverse is trivial for a diagonal matrix. Good. So we know that. And since we would never leave T once we get there, because it's an absorbing random walk, we would have MIT is zero for all I, yeah? Good. Now, one thing that you need to note is that, coming from the tradition of Markov processes and Markov transition matrices, the indices are just reversed from what you might read, okay? So MIJ is the probability of getting to I when I'm in J, yeah? So that's something that's just maybe reversed from your intuition. And this is not affected in terms of A, since for the moment we'll assume that we'd have an undirected graph and thus a symmetric adjacency matrix. Good. And that's why being in T, you would never get somewhere else, because you'll be absorbed, like you can never leave, okay? And good. So what we can do is we can remove column T and also row T without affecting our transitions. And once again, this matrix M where T is removed, the column T is denoted by that, okay? Now, what we can do is if we have that matrix and we perform R steps, what we must do is just compute the Rth power of that matrix. Yeah? Because that's also clear from Markov processes, if you've ever come across Markov processes. Okay? So for a walk starting at the source, the probability of finding ourselves at J after R steps is just M to the R, where we left out T, so MT to the R, and the JS component of that, right? So I start in S, and what is the probability of arriving at J? Yeah? Now, now we're in J, right? And we know that the probability to make a step to some adjacent matrix, adjacent vertex I, is then given by 1 over kj. And we already have this probability of being in J. So that's the total probability that we then make a step to I, assuming that starting from the beginning, so to speak. Okay? So that is the same expression from the previous slide. Now, what we need to do now is to say, okay, I can make one step, I can make several steps, or I can investigate walks of length 1, 2, 3, R plus 1, R plus 2, and so on. So what we need is we need to sum over R from 0 to infinity. And if MT is a well-behaved matrix, what we see is that since we're in the realm of linear algebra, we would have something like the geometric series. Okay? And the question is, what are the preliminaries for that? Okay. So you know from calculus that sum from n equal to 0 to infinity of q to the n is 1 over 1 minus q, and q is a real number. Okay, that's just the geometric series. And having said that we're in linear algebra, q could, or in this case mt, could also be a matrix. Yeah, like if you have r from 0 to infinity, mt to the power r, what we get is also something like this. Now, you might ask yourself, come on, a matrix in the denominator, what's that supposed to be? Yeah, and you would have to define that, right? So that's the identity matrix minus mt, and that computed the matrix inverse, okay? And this is true if certain conditions hold. And in that case, what we need is that all the eigenvalues of that matrix need to be smaller than 1. So that's the analog of q being so q being smaller than 1, okay? Or the absolute value, right? And so here we have the same analogous, and that's just written on the slide. So if all the eigenvalues are smaller than 1, or their absolute value, I should say, then we can really use that geometric series. Okay? Now, since MT is a matrix containing probabilities, and since it's well behaved in a certain sense, this is the case for our considerations. So what we can say is that we can really compute that geometric series and end up with this expression. Yeah. So this expression formalizes the total number of times we go from J to A, I, or averaged over all possible walks. Okay, and in matrix notation, we have something like this. And this would then just simplify to that, okay? Since the inverse matrix times an inverse matrix, we can pull in the dt here, right? So we have dt minus, and mt times dt would just be the adjacency matrix via that equation. Okay, so that's the result. And if you remember that from the electrical current case, what you see is that random walking gives the same as solving for electrical currents and voltages. Okay, and I think that's interesting because this electrical model seems to be very intuitive from a social point of view. And the random walk model is also very intuitive, and I find it intriguing that they're actually the same. And that's what the paper by Mark Newman is just about. Okay? Good. So computing this, I showed you that slide yesterday as well, computing this for these two example graphs would just yield the desired properties that we were after, right? So if you regard the table below, right, we have three columns at the right. The first column computes the value of shortest path betweenness for values A and B, and also for this critique vertex C. And we see that in case of the shortest path betweenness, C gets a substantially lower value than A and B, which we thought would be socially not very logical, right? And if you do that with flow-based centrality situation or max flow-based centrality, we would get 0.282 instead of 0.200, which is, pointed to the wrong column. So this here are the values for network one, right? So that's network one here. And the critique in terms of flow was for network two, right? So that's not a number that's interesting for us. That's the number that's interesting. And that's way too low, okay? It's 0.004 compared to 0.269 for A and B, right? So that's several orders of magnitude too small, following our intuition, right? And I have to stress that max flow between this is based on the graph flow, not on this current flow. Yeah? So keep those two terms apart. Now, our new measure, right, that's computed in that fashion, and we saw that this is random walk as well as current flow, would give much more realistic values. Yeah. So for network one, we have a much more comparable size of the or magnitude of the respective centralities, and the same is true for network two. Right. So now we would have for this node C here. 0.267, which is rather comparable to this 0.321 for A and B, right? So what we saw is that these measures are able to better formalize our social intuition about information flow or workflows, okay? So that's something that's useful here. Now, for the games engineering students, the question may arise, okay, good, cool, all right. What I got was your story that social games are a subset of social computing. And what I also get is that somehow friendships are interesting, so we're in the network realm, all granted. But what can I do with these things in games? Okay. And the answer will come up in the third assignment of your lab course, because what we would do there is make use of our network measures that we learned for a case that's gold farmer detection, right? So if that's not precisely about designing games, but it's about analyzing what happens in your game and in the community playing your game. And that's something you can, if you find the gold farmers with respect to the characteristic network patterns that they assume, yeah, then you would be able to like throw them out on a jurisdictional level, but you could also integrate these analyses in your game itself, right? And I think that's at least an interesting application there. And you might ask yourself, what do centralities have to do with gold farmer detection? And the answer is that if you analyze mafia networks, yeah. There is characteristic organizational patterns, right? And the keyword is that you work in isolation. You work with isolated cells. That has been a principle for terrorist groups, for mafia groups as well, because if you work with these isolated cells that have only very few or single connections, for example, to their bosses, then the chance of the whole network being uncovered, if one of the nodes is like arrested, is much smaller. So you can find these characteristic network topologies and identify them. And that's what people do in social computing research, analyzing mafia networks, terrorist networks, and so on, right? One more time, the ethical dimension is something that we must not forget, since if we really rely on those measures and say, you're a terrorist because your centrality value is blah, 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 we certainly see the dangers of that, right? So we must not attribute too much truth in our analysis. And that's very important. This is not a deterministic thing. And we may not blame people without further analysis and further measures, right? And I mention that because I think it's a key problem of this branch of computer science. Yeah. So in a sense, these big data type of or big data applicable techniques carry the risk of blaming persons that are really innocent. So you must, please, you must be aware of limits and chances, and especially the limits of these techniques. And don't apply them in a blue-eyed fashion. Yeah? And be always aware of the dangers. And I perfectly accept if people say, I'm not going to do research like that because of the inherent dangers. But we know that being able to see the dangers is also something that is necessary. You are the ones that will be in those positions. You are the ones that have to decide. So keep that in mind, please. Good. Now, for the end of this centrality part, we are going to look at a last family of centrality measures that's well known to most of you. Right? And that's feedback centrality, or the family of feedback centrality measures. And its idea is rather simple. So the idea is that a node is important if it's connected to other important nodes. So that's a recursive definition, and we will fill that with some life. Okay? Example, the Hubble index. Okay? Assume that you start from a weighted directed graph. So the adjacency matrix is not a matrix with binary entries only. So, but instead this weight matrix or weighted adjacency matrix contains the weights. And it's not symmetric since it's a directed graph. Okay. Now, if we say that the centrality of some node V is assumed to be proportional to the sum of centralities of its adjacent nodes, how can we formalize that? The answer is via that eigenvector equation. Okay? So, the centrality of a node is the sum of centralities of its adjacent nodes. And that's just exactly what this matrix multiplication does. Okay? Since you know matrix multiplication, to just repeat that, yeah? So if I write W times S, what does that mean? So W is a matrix and S is a vector. Now, what I sum over is the inner index, yeah? So Wij Sj, yeah? That's exactly what I do, okay? This is just normal matrix multiplication. And if I say S is W times S, I have Sj is this. And what I do here, I sum over all the centralities of the other nodes that I am incident to or are adjacent to. So for those nodes that I'm not adjacent to, this value Wij is just zero. So the weight is zero. And for all the others, where the weight is non-zero, I just sum it up, right? So that's just this matrix multiplication. And, so the whole equation, S is equal to WS, this is just a trivial eigenvector equation. Yeah, so the eigenvalue that we seek for is 1 in that case. Yeah, so usually you would have the eigenvalue before S here, okay? Now, as before, this equation is not directly solvable. What we need to solve it is some, centrality input or some external information coming from somewhere else. And you could either start this with a constant centrality input of some sort, or you could say, I have some information that does not come from the graph structure, but maybe from machine learning based data mining. Yeah. So that's the second way of addressing these things. Yeah. And, so using this external information, we would alter the equation in that fashion. So S is now not only equal to W times S, but also plus this centrality input. And we could now, at least in principle, solve for S by inverting the identity matrix minus W times E. Okay, so this can be written as the product of E times 1 plus W times S, and we can invert that and get the solution here. Okay, and one more time, I minus W is invertible if our geometric series converges, and in that case, this condition must hold. Okay, good. And that's this Hubble index, and it's a characteristic that you have this feedback idea. In that case, implemented via that sum, and you also have this matrix inversion involved. Okay, to come up with the actual solution. Okay. Now, another example is this random surfer, which is, yeah, practically identical to this random walk that we discussed. So we have our Markov transition matrix one more time. In that case, as 1 over the out degree of I. Yeah. So if we unweight it, we could just leave out that plus. And 0 if the nodes are not adjacent. And what we alter here is a random transition if the out degree of the respective node is 0. And what we apply this to for the moment is hypertext graphs, right? It's documents on the web. If you randomly select links, then this transition probability to some other page is 1 over the number of links in the original page. That's exactly what we had before with this random walker. Okay. Good. And that's if you want to avoid getting stuck in circles, we can add a small random probability of going somewhere or going to some node that you're not incident to. So these are random jumps that kind of make the problem more convenient. Okay. And what we can ask ourselves, if we have this Markov type of thinking, yeah, is there a unique stationary distribution of that random surfer? Okay. And what we need to ensure is that this probability transition matrix for the Markov chain has certain properties. Yeah, it must be irreducible and positively recurrent. These are things that you can just accept. And then, if these properties are fulfilled, we can get more or less trivially compute the stationary distribution. Yeah, and again, in order to make it irreducible, we can add a completely stochastic choice. So instead of the zero here, we can add to, or not only instead of zero, we can add this completely stochastic choice with a certain to a certain degree. Yeah, so alpha is certainly close to 1. To not completely alter the problem. And what we see is that, as we discussed before, there is a social analog, okay? And if we have such a stationary distribution, how can we find that? And the statement is that this unique stationary distribution is given by this expression here. Yeah. Okay. Now, is that easy to see? The answer is yes, it's easy to see, because that's the original transition matrix. Okay. And what we do is we want to see that this distribution times the transition matrix gives the distribution back. Yeah. And if you want an interpretation for this distribution, so you start at some node, yeah, make random, follow random links, and then you might say, okay, if I start somewhere, I end somewhere. Where are the probabilities? Okay. And this is always the thinking with Markov chains. You can start at any node you want with a certain probability. And this probability is the beginning. So that's a vector where all the components sum up to one. So that's the probability, corresponds to the probabilities of starting somewhere. And then you can propagate this vector with this transition matrix until you, for, yeah, as many steps as you like. Okay. And if we have this property that pi is a eigenvector of t, then we have a stationary distribution, which is not changed anymore. Okay. And you might ask yourself, wait a second, why do we multiply this vector from the left and not from the right as usual? And the answer is that we'd have this inverted notion, right? So Tij is the probability of going from J to I. And that's usual with Markov chains, all the same notation around in all the books, okay? Now, if we investigate the jth component of that, what we need is this multiplication of vector times matrix. And then we need to insert the statement here and our knowledge of the transition matrix. Yeah? And if we insert both terms, what we get is this expression. Okay? Good. And we first insert pi and then we insert v. Now, what you can already see is that these degrees cancel. And what we end up with is this equation. So this new denominator here we find again, and we'd have to sum over all I because of that matrix multiplication. So we're not having only Aij here, but sum over I Aij. Okay. Now the only thing that is non-trivial of that proof is to recognize that summing over a column of, over the columns of a matrix while holding the row index constant would just give us the degree of that respective node. That's something we had before. Yeah. So sum over I, Ij gives the degree of J. And then we would find back our original proposition. Okay. And why do we do that? The answer is, because we want to end up at page rank, okay? And you all know that page rank is, or used to be at the center of Google's, algorithm to rank search results. So what Google essentially does is some sophisticated way of matching the query with the documents. And out of that matching process, at least in traditional information retrieval, you can already derive a certain ranking schema, but that ranking schema is not very good. So the old search engines like AltaVista, for example, or the original Yahoo search engine did only that. Yeah. So decide on the ranking of the search results just on the basis of that match between query and document. But PageRank is a bit more intelligent because it takes into consideration how important the page really is. Yeah? And you would accept a higher ranking for a page that may fit in certain sense less to the query, but which is more important in terms of PageRank. And that's what Google does in some weird way, which nobody knows, okay? But people know how PageRank works. And So the essential idea one more time is that a node is, or a web page is important if it links to other important web pages. Okay, and that's certainly something that's reasonable in terms of hubs and authorities. So for the moment, we would only assume that something is a good hub. So we would regard the out degrees, so the links pointing from that page. And so one more time, we have this equation with 1/degree of this respective page, and we would sum over all the respective neighbors. And in order to rectify or make the solution, make this equation solvable, we have something that we might call a damping factor. Okay? That's just a trick if you want to make that thing solvable. So if you have this equation, which is one version of page rank, actually, and if you denote this in matrix notation, you have exactly that. And again, we have this typical eigenstructure here modified just by these damping factors. And the transition matrix, one more time, is more or less the transition matrix of the random surfer. Okay? Or, yeah, it is, in a sense. Okay? Now, if we want to solve that equation, we, if D is within 0 and 1, the statement is that this equation has a solution, and it's, you can get that solution by just inverting 1 minus P, in a sense. Yeah, so 1 minus DP, to be more exact. Now, you can say, wait a second, how many web pages are there? Like a trillion, a gazillion? Yeah. So can we, in some sense, hope for solving a matrix inversion problem with so many entries? And the answer is naturally we can't. But what we can do is, instead of trying to solve that problem analytically, what we can do is we can use Jacobi iteration to solve the equation. So we start with some idea of C and then perceive this right side of the equation as a transformation recipe to arrive at the C of the next step. Okay, so if we are at iteration K, what we must do is just to insert this here into the right side, and we would get the C of the next iteration. Okay, that's this precisely the idea of Jacobi iteration. So you can look up that in some numeric book if you don't know the backgrounds. And if you make use of the components that you already know during computing that, this is Gauss-Seidel iteration, you can speed up the convergence. Now, the difference is that if you have already computed this thing, yeah, up to an index I, you already know the K plus one components, yeah. So these are the ones that you have already computed, and you would just have to make use of the kth only for this, yeah. So what you do is you reuse what you already know. So that just speeds up the computation. And I'm not saying that Google does exactly that, but that's a way to compute page rank like centralities. Okay. And this is, if you compare this to Mark Newman's analysis of a random surfer, yeah, in a sense, random walk in that case, you would find that the solutions are rather similar. So this version of PageRank discussed in the book article is rather similar to that, in a sense. Yeah, good. So that was good. Oh, just a hint that this is not the power, but just the superscript of the numerical iteration, right? Now, that was that. Okay. So sum up. we have seen a lot of ways to compute centralities, and among them are rather famous versions like PageRank, which everybody knows and uses, like shortest path betweenness, and also these connections between all of these centrality measures. And there are other countless centrality measures, but these are at least some of the more prominent ideas that you can have when you want to analyze the importance of a node or an edge. And this can be used in various analyses in social computing, as I said. For example, this gold farmer detection. And many, many papers make use of centrality measures. Good. As always, I have this recommended reading. So for those that are not really interested in the subjects, try to really understand what's going on the slides. Try to fill the gaps by thinking about it. So that's a good way to learn. Take the slides and ask yourself, come on, why is that like, I have to think about this. And while you're doing this, you're networking your brain. Yeah, so that's how I learned in most of the cases for my exams. Now, the standard approach would be to read the corresponding chapters in the network analysis chapter, book chapter, and also the corresponding parts of Mark Newman's paper. And for the interested students, I have another paper that I recommend to you. And one more time, if you've got problems with graph theory and math and these things, the article, the book article, chapter number 2, is a good source. It has just 6 pages or so. Yeah, so that's not really a large effort. And as always, I have the questions. Yeah, good. So 9:15. So we have a bit more of time to just continue our journey into network analysis with the next chapter. Okay. Good. Good. And the next chapter will be about something that's also intensely discussed in sociology. Okay. So the first thing, centralities, was about binary relations, okay? Friendships, stuff like that. And another important thing, obviously, are groups, right? Groups of all sorts. And we would investigate groups from 2 points of view in that lecture. The first one would be by seeking certain prototypes of dense subnetworks in graphs, and the other approach would be via clustering. And I would, in the upcoming lectures, I will introduce you to clustering, to certain clustering techniques to kind of lead you towards machine learning. Okay, so we will be covering the very, very essential basics of machine learning and its ideas to be able to understand social signal processing. Yeah, but that's just the upcoming stuff. Okay, good. So having that said already, what's the most basic structure that we can think of in terms of long-term social context? And the answer is groups, right? And groups do play a role in science in very many places. Yeah, and this picture here is from an artist group, which is known here in the region, because, as you know, if you move farther south, there are a lot of famous expressionists having worked there, like Kandinsky and others, Münter and so on. And so necessarily in art history, people talk about artist groups. And these groups are not just statistical, or just formed by saying that all the expressionists form a group. No, for example, Der Blaue Reiter was a famous expressionist group in that region here, and they knew each other and they formed a real sociological group. In computer science, you would find groups if you talk about CSCW, groupware, and these rather older terms in social computing. Even in Unix, you have groups, right? In law science, you have groups as legal entities, right? But the cursor, okay, good. We have to wait because Microsoft's 15 seconds. Thank you. The nice 15 seconds. Okay, relax. Oh, sorry. Not enough time. Not enough time for the cursor. Nice. Good. However, as you can see, history, ethnological groups, sociological groups, yeah, obviously, since sociology is largely about groups. Oh, thank you, thank you, thank you so much, Microsoft. Thank you, thank you. Cool. So we have that. So groups are an important thing. And in social psychology, groups as objects of consideration have been around for a long time, as you can imagine. And there is, even in the 19th century, Ferdinand Tönnies reasoned about things as the Gemeinschaft versus Gesellschaft. And in the 1930s, small group research came up, and we will see what the difference is. And what's interesting is that historically there is, yeah, basically, as far as I've read, two schools of thought. So the individualist school of thought would trace back all phenomena in regard to groups on the diets of the persons making up the groups. Okay, so if you have a group of four persons, you would have 4/2 binary relations between those people. And if you know all the binary relations, you know everything that happens in the group, at least basically. Yeah, so that's about breaking down all the analysis to diets, yeah, to graphs. And that's why we are going to talk about dense subnetworks in graphs. The graphs are just formalizations of dyadic social relations in our case. Yeah? And the collectivistic school of thought said, okay, well, there are properties of groups that we cannot analyze by just analyzing the dyads. So this would correspond in a modern view to something that we might call emergence. Right? So we already had that. An emergent phenomenon is a phenomenon that where the properties of that phenomenon cannot easily be understood by analyzing the subcomponents of the problem. Yeah? The example was organisms like a beehive, for example. Yeah? Good. And a definition for group giving by the sociologist Thomans is noted down there. So what is emphasized there is that communication is really important. And what's also emphasized is that this communication needs to take place in a certain span of time. Okay. So if what we need in groups, in other words, is frequent communication. And another aspect is that the number of persons in the group needs to be small, okay? Because for a true sociological small group, yeah, we would have to respect the perceptual limits of humans. And there are certain figures around in sociology stating that the highest number of persons that we can group interact with at a time is between 20 and 30, right, something. So it varies whatever source you consider. But however, it's clear that we cannot maintain group interaction in groups of 200, Yeah, because that's just beyond your socially, your social perception. You cannot interact with that many people in a group, at least not in a coherent group interaction way. Other larger, pseudo groups like a political party are just pseudo groups, and they're not really socially very relevant in the first place. Yeah, and what Homans also emphasizes is that we need to have face-to-face communication, which is interesting because certainly we as computer scientists would have no problems of also accepting electronically mediated communication between persons. However, sociologically, it is not sufficient to really establish a group. Yeah, you can, for example, have a group in ICQ that often meets and often chats and so on, or even groups playing games, but the interaction will necessarily be rather limited. Yeah. However, this is arguable. Yeah. So you can say, I accept this, and the electronic mediation for the communication is so rich and so similar to real life interaction that your mind, your social mind, can be tricked in a sense. Yeah. So if you have a World of Warcraft, you can move around. They're real human-looking avatars. They can do human-like interactions. So why not accept this as groups as well here? Yeah. Good. Now, here I reference that the number of group members needs to be smaller than 20, actually, which is one source stating the human social perception limit. Okay. What we often have is common goals, common norms, communication habits, and roles and effect structures. So the roles and effect structures are something that is a thing that can be typically broken down into these dyads. Yeah. Who takes which role in the group. And what they also have, think of the definition on the previous slide, is some sort of group awareness. People know that they form a group. And what we need to distinguish is our small groups. So these are the groups in the more in the sense that we mean. And we have to compare this to large groups, which for which the political party is an example. And these are the ones that we are not really after in our consideration. We also have more terms characterizing groups, for example, primary versus secondary groups. So this has to do with social identity. You have a group that you primarily identify yourself with, or that's very important to you, whereas secondary groups are less so. In-group is the group that I'm in, and that has to be compared to other groups. These are out-groups, so the group of the others or other groups. Quasi-groups are groups that are found by data mining only. Yeah. So, for example, the group of all persons being taller than 1.80 meters. Yeah. This is not obviously not a real sociologically relevant group, but that's just one via clustering. And there are lots of other terms, groups versus mass, cliques, gangs, communities, companies, and so on and so on. Okay. And and a thing that is maybe important for social computing researchers is social identity theory, coming from the mid-1980s by Teufel, and he said that we determine our social identity via our membership in groups, right? And that's very typical, and we find that in the gaming scene as well as in life science-based, spare time-based groupings, like, for example, Gothic people with their uniforms, black and white faces, and so on. And in a sense, that gives persons social identity. And you cannot avoid defining your social identity over your membership in groups, at least if you're not a really solitary character, right? And from that some secondary phenomena arise. For example, that the similarity of me to other in-group members is perceived as much higher as the similarity to out-group members, right? So a typical example, computer science students, the nerds, yeah, kind of would see that term rather more like funny or more like even positive, yeah? While like the economic students would say, ah, that's the out-group and I despise them, and maybe they're despised by computer science students as well. I don't know, yeah? But this is something that has to do with social identity theory, yeah? Good. Why am I saying that? Because these things have their implications, for example, when you want to do social search. Yeah? So if you're after Facebook's graph search and you want to implement more elaborate versions of social search, then the normative effects of groups would play an important role to get interesting results. Yeah? Good. This is something I also already mentioned. So we have two ways to determine groups that we're going to cover. Today, we're going to start with determining groups as dense prototypes of dense networks in social networks. And the other access path is via data mining and clustering. That's something we're going to cover in upcoming lectures. Yeah? Okay, so let's start. So we're still back in our realm of networks and graphs, and what is it that we want to demand of a group? Yeah? And certainly dense subnetworks have four properties. So they are dense, as the name says, meaning that nodes typically have a large neighborhood within the substructure. Yeah? And that corresponds to something that I might call at the moment intra-cluster coherence. Yeah? So clustering will always be about maximizing intra-cluster coherence. So the group itself is coherent in itself and it is distinguished from other groups. And that is formalized by inter-cluster decoherence. Okay. So that was density compactness, meaning that the average path length within the group are especially small. And that goes along with that the connectivity is high. We're going to define that later. Also corresponds to intra-cluster coherence. We have mutuality. So if you regard directed graphs, you would find that within groups, the ties are typically reciprocal. Yeah? So in a social group, it's not conceivable that you know somebody and this person doesn't know you back. It can be the case that the weights are different. For example, that I like you better than you like me. That's certainly possible. But still, we have the tendency in groups to have a balanced reciprocal two edges between nodes, okay? And separation is the last one, so group members have more ties within the group than outside, okay? It's also something, that's something that formalizes intercluster decoherence in a certain sense. And all these criteria, as you might have guessed already, are not really independent, yeah? So, for example, there's a theorem stating that if each member is connected to at least one over k other members, if k is the size, then the distance between the members is at most k. Yeah, so, or k is just one number that kind of steers that, right? So if you're connected to at least one over k other members, you would find that the distance is small, actually. Yeah, good. And what we will do is we will look at certain prototypes, certain models that fulfill these criteria, and we would call them locally dense subgraphs. And we would talk about cliques, clans, plexes, and so on. Look at algorithms to compute them, And in most cases, we will find that we'd have a hard time to compute them because the respective problems are NP-hard. And what we will do for simplicity to look at undirected graphs for the moment, but the results are transferable to directed graphs as well. Okay? And at the end of today's lecture, the only thing that we will do is look at the most famous version of a dense subnetwork, and that's a clique. So a clique is a subset of nodes in a graph that's complete. Yeah? So every node is connected to every other node. And an important notation is that if you call this U, this subset, then G of square brackets of U is the subgraph that's induced by this set of nodes, right? So all the edges that are between nodes U in the original graph, and this subgraph is then called the subgraph induced by that set U. Yeah? And two terms. So a clique is called maximal if you cannot add other nodes or additional nodes to that set without violating the clique property. Yeah? So you cannot make it larger. That's important because naturally if you have a clique, then this clique can be separated in smaller cliques. And the example is if I have something like that, yeah, so that's a complete graph consisting of four nodes, then naturally this would contain lots of these triangles, and these triangles are again complete graphs with three nodes. And even that is a trivial clique, yeah, because it's a complete subgraph containing two nodes. Yeah. And in a sense, this is also a clique, yeah. But for most considerations, we will not consider them cliques, yeah, because these are too trivial. Yeah. So that's the notion of maximal clique. And this needs to be distinguished from maximum cliques. And a maximum clique in a graph is just the largest clique that's in the graph. And certainly the maximum clique is also maximal. Yeah. But not every maximal clique is the maximum clique. Okay. Why are cliques so nice? Yeah, well, they're in a sense perfect. They are perfectly dense. So the maximum degree of the graph is U minus 1, and the minimum degree is also U minus 1. Yeah? So each node in U is connected to cardinality of U minus 1 other nodes, to all the other nodes. Okay, and the average degree is also U minus 1. Yeah? So all these numbers are equal and, in a sense, perfect. Yeah? They're perfectly compact because the diameter is 1. So the mean average path length corresponding to that is also 1. They're perfectly connected. And what do we mean with perfectly connected? So if the size of the clique in question is K, then the graph induced by the clique is what we call K minus 1 vertex connected and also K minus 1 edge connected. And what does that mean, that K edge or K vertex connection? So a graph is, yeah, K or N vertex connected if you can take out a subset of N or K nodes, and the resulting graph is still connected. Yeah? So in a sense, this K connectedness kind of models the stability under taking away certain nodes. Okay? If a subgraph is very fragile in that sense, and it contains of two sub graphs connected by one edge only, and you take away this one edge, then the group is not connected anymore. So it's not very stable with respect to taking away. And so the clique is the most stable structure there is. Yeah, so you can take away very many of these nodes or edges, and the resulting substructure would still be connected. Okay, good. So that's that, and we'll end with that. So to sum up, we started to dig into prototypes for dense subgraphs, and these prototypes are intended to be models for groups, certain models for groups. And in the next lecture on next Tuesday, we will talk about algorithms that kind of compute these structures and other structures that are relaxations of that. Because some of you might already know from theoretical computer science that a lot of decision problems that have to do with cliques are NP-hard or NP-complete. Yeah. So if you have a social network and you want to compute all the cliques, yeah, then you'd be having a hard time, because a lot of graphs have an exponential number of cliques, and there is, as long as P is not equal to NP, there is no real chance that we can solve the corresponding problems. However, we'll introduce an algorithm that at least allows you to enumerate cliques with a certain delay, and that would give you a black box that spits out cliques in your graph. And if you're just interested in some cliques for your analysis and do not require all of them, then you can work with stuff like that. Okay? So, and once again, point you to the background reading. If you didn't grasp all of it, it's explained in there. And if you have questions, you're cordially invited after the lectures to address me, and we'll discuss anything in relation to that. Okay? So thank you, and see you on next Tuesday. Yeah?